So today's koan is Bodhidharma puts the mind to rest. I think you did this at the Teshin, didn't you? Okay, it was another one. Okay. So this is quite an interesting koan. It's very dear to my heart because, you know, in many ways, you know, this is really the quest that a lot of people have when they come to Zen. Their main issue is to put the mind to rest. But not just in Zen, also when we go to prison, you know, there's a lot of people that have got a very unrestful mind. You know, there's heavy, heavy karma. And in many ways, you know, putting the mind to rest, of course, is the alleviation of suffering, which is nothing other than the entire Buddhist project, nothing other than the Zen project. So this is very much a case that deals with that. I'll just read the case out. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second ancestor standing in the snow cut off his arm and said, "Your disciple's mind is not at peace. I beg you, Master, put it to rest." Bodhidharma said, "Bring your mind to me and I will give it rest." And the second ancestor said, "I have searched for the mind, but have never been able to find it." And Bodhisattva said, "I have finished putting it to rest for you." Most of you would have heard of Bodhidharma being the 28th Indian patriarch and being, of course, the first ancestor in the Chinese tradition because he came from India to China. And I think I talked about this at length before. But there is something that's really interesting, and this sort of the beginning of the story of Bodhidharma. We've got to understand before he got there, before he got to China, he was already quite old. Apparently, he left at 520, and he was already a very old man. We don't really know what time he when he was born, whether he even existed. There's conjecture about all of that. But anyway, he was quite old. He did this arduous journey from India into China. And he was the son, he was the third son of a king, and very early on discovered that the Dharma was his vocation, if you like. And his master told him that after the master died, he basically tasked him to go to China after so many years. So by the time he came to China, he would have been, according to legend, he would have been already well into his 90s by the sounds of it. So anyway, he got to China and Zen recognizes Bodhidharma as the 28th lineage holder of Buddha. You know, so the 28th patriarch for all the way in India. And the first, of course, because he's the first one to bring Zen or Chan to China, it's the first ancestor in China. That doesn't mean that Buddhism wasn't in China already. It was already. So he came to China around the year 500. Buddhism, as I've mentioned before in other Teishos, was already there since the first century. But the way Buddhists got introduced into China, similarly, the way it is introduced into Australia or the way Buddhism is introduced into the West or generally, was basically textual. So you could say it was textual Buddhism. And people then, you know, had these new texts. They liked what they saw and they adhered to them. They formed schools and so on. There's a whole methodology that developed around these different sutras, around these texts. So Bodhidharma came, and apparently his first encounter was with Emperor Wu. And Emperor Wu was what they call another sage emperor, if you like, or a sage ruler. He's very, very dedicated to Buddhism. And he knew, by all accounts, he knew his Buddhism really well. He would have known already about the two truths. He would have known already about all the concepts of emptiness and form is emptiness, emptiness is form. He would have known everything there is to know at that time because he was a good scholar. He would have had the best teachers. You know, he would have known everything. So he definitely wanted to meet this new fella that came all the way from India because he was he's been told that, you know, here comes a true master from India. So he wanted to meet this master. So the story goes that Bodhidharma then went and confronted Emperor Wu. And in their first encounter, again, this is all legend, it's legendary, so please, it doesn't have to be true, since it's all legend, as I always say, legends are quite more interesting than the truth sometimes. So the legend is that the Emperor Wu said to Bodhidharma, I have built all these monasteries. I have made sure that so many people have come to Buddhism. Please tell me, what merit have I gained by doing all of this? What is my merit? And Bodhidharma replied, no merit at all. No merit at all. And you can imagine the shock, you know, because this is the way Buddhism was taught, cause and effect. You do good, good will come to you. That's the merit. You do something that's good, the merit is that something will come to you. You know? And of course, you know, there's a whole, in many countries, even still today, there's a whole merit economy. There's a whole economy like in Thailand that is built on this concept of merit. And here is this Bodhidharma coming from India saying no merit at all. That's the first thing. Then you can just only imagine what the emperor, you know, would have felt at this. Then he asked, well, if that's the case, what is the first principle of Buddhism? It was a great question. If there's no merit, what is the first principle of Buddhism? You know, all these texts, all it, like, if I asked you, what's the first principle of Buddhism? And Bodhidharma replied, vast emptiness. Vast emptiness. Nothing holy. Again. Can imagine the shock, vast emptiness, nothing holy. And then he must have gotten a little bit perplexed, this emperor. He said, who are you telling me all of this? Who are you telling me all of this? And Bodhidharma replied, I don't know. We've got three things here. No karma. No karma. Vast and void. Emptiness. And I don't know. Those three things. Then the story keeps going that obviously they didn't gel. Bodhidharma and the emperor didn't gel. And Bodhidharma left. Most of you would have heard this story. But one of the things that this story tells us, it tells us the limits of textual Buddhism, or the limits of conceptual Buddhism, or the limits, if you like, of intellectual Buddhism. And, you know, as we always say here, you know, this is what Zen is about. And that is what Bodhidharma brought to China. That is the part that is not transmittable. This vast and void. That's the part that cannot be transmitted. You can transmit texts, and you can transmit concepts, you know, but we cannot transmit the true Dharma. And this was Bodhidharma's gift to China. Bodhidharma then went to Chelon Temple, a very famous Chelon Temple. And of course, there's where the karate and martial arts, you know, sort of the source of all of this. And at Ceylon Temple, you know, he is even considered Bodhidharma as the founder of all the martial arts over there. Whether that is true or not, I don't know. But so the story goes. He went to Ceylon Temple and he sat facing the wall for 9 years after this encounter with Bodhidharma. So, and this is now where this koan starts. He sat facing the wall for 9 years. But before I go there, you know, just a little bit of background on the second ancestor, Jinko, you know, Hyuke in Chinese. He was born 487, died 593. He was a scholar monk. And I've read also that he was a general somewhere, in his career. But I can't verify that. There was only one person that wrote this. Where they got that from? I checked as much as I could. I checked it out, but I couldn't really find any source for that. He had a few teachers. He went searching. He had a long search before he finally got to Bodhidharma. And this is where this koan starts here today. He apparently died during execution because he had some heavy karma. A lot of people, you know, when I was reading the background of Jinko, I was reading that he had heavy karma. And there was apparently a dispute where some famous priest was teaching something. He came in and he was teaching something. And all the people moved away from this famous master, whatever, whoever he was, and listened to Jinko. And the master got very upset and started slandering. And that became such a big problem that eventually he got executed. So that, and people say that was that, you know, the karma has been fulfilled. That was his karma to be executed. So that's just a little side story on this. So let's have a look at the koan now. First of all, Bodhidharma starts off with Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. So here we have the first goal in Zen. So if you remember, the first goal of Zen is Zazen. We sit facing the wall. And this is quite an interesting a point, because in many ways, you know, we sit facing the wall. You know, so we always sit outwards in our tradition. Some people sit inwards, but that doesn't matter. But this is where this is coming from. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. Remember, this whole Zen started, like the Zen tradition, not the Buddhist tradition, but the Zen tradition started with Bodhidharma coming into China. So facing the wall has become a hallmark, if you like, of Zazen, in the Zen tradition. So what is this facing the wall? One of the things that you could see when you face the wall is like, you know, there's just a wall. There's just a white wall. You know, it's almost like you could say an empty sheet of paper. There's nothing on there. But we start sitting. Things appear. Oh, there's a spot. Or cold. Things appear on this empty wall. I don't want to sit. Why am I sitting here? It is never ending what appears on this wall. We sit facing the wall. We melt into mu. Mu appears, as in mu. Just appears. The wall. Wow. Our object of concentration appears the wall. I'm thirsty, appears on the wall. And we sit in front of an empty sheet of paper and it continuously appears. And so for beginners, the best instruction is melt into mu. Melt into whatever your object of concentration is. Melt into mu. Melt into the wall. Whatever the wall is nothing other than your object of concentration, whatever that is. When you're driving, it's driving. When you're sitting, it's sitting. What is the wall? Melt into wall. Melt into move. Melt into driving. Melt into doing the dishes. Melt into any type of activity. And of course what happens, and this is why it takes so long, is we separate. We see ourselves as separate from the wall. And the practice is one of embodying or of letting go of this separation or of this, you can say me, letting go of it so much that there is only wall. There is only an empty plain sheet of paper, totally neutral. Things appear, they disappear. It arises and it ceases. And you may notice, those of you that know the Four Noble Truths, you know, suffering, separation, me, wall, it arises and it ceases. It arises and it ceases. Comes and it goes. Comes and it goes. Whatever your suffering is, it comes and it goes. So this is Bodhidharma's gift. This is a real gift that is his method. Sit. This is what the Zen method is. Sit facing the wall. Or sitting, just sitting. Don't get hung up on wall by all means. You know, just sitting. Doesn't matter whether you look at the carpet or whether it's you close your eyes, it's just move. Whatever that is. So the wall, the empty piece of paper, is always unchanging. It's empty, it's blank. It's a blank sheet of paper. It is always blank. It is always unchanging. We will realize this the more we sit. We will get a real taste for that. There is nothing there. It is always unchanging. But it appears. Wow, what appear? What is this appearance that comes up? Oh, it's cold. Again, unchanging. It's just, it's cold. Until we realize that there is no separation between, oh, it's a bit cold today, and wall or empty paper, we are stuck in separation. We melt into our object of concentration. We melt into our thoughts. We melt when we do chicken tasa, when we just sit. We melt into whatever is occurring. It's nothing other than a blank piece of paper. So then the story goes. So in the koan, it starts, Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second ancestor standing in the snow cut off his arm. So here we can see that there is really deep commitment. He cut off his arm. Yeah. So apparently, I was reading Aitken Roshi's Teisho on this, and he was saying that even still today, in the East or Japan or China, to show really deep commitment, people actually may cut off a finger. I'm not sure whether he cut off an arm or not. That seems irreparable, and he probably would have died if he did that. But he tells the story of this this lady that wanted to become a monastic, and the parents didn't let them. And if you're underage, you have to get the permission from the parents to become a monastic. And she was so distraught because that is what she wanted to do. She went to her father and cut her finger off. And when they realized that, when they saw that, they allowed her to become a monastic. So there is something to this story. There was real commitment to find this peace that they were looking for. This unrest was driving them crazy. They needed to find what it was that gave them peace of mind. And today, when I look at that, when I thought about this, today I would argue that, or I would say that, you know, we can still see that. You know, some people go to enormous lengths to study the Dharma. You know, they, like when I even look at Rosalind, you know, my grandmother in the Dharma, you know, Mervyn and Cecily's teacher, she left her tenure as a professor to go to Japan and study. You know, she lived very humbly in a tiny little one bedroom flat in Kamakura, and for years, you know, to go through all her koan practice with the Roshi. That is quite a commitment. You know, there is a drive there. You know, and that's and this is sort of the drive that you know Jinko had. Okay, he had this drive to really find out what it was. And Bodhidharma, especially after his encounter with Emperor Wu, he wasn't interested in talking to people that weren't really that committed. If, you know, they weren't. What is there to transmit anyway? You know, what did he transmit? What is there to transmit anyway? But when he saw that commitment, he said, okay, come on in. And he asked them, what do you want? What is it that you're seeking? And so we now come to the second line. The ancestors, standing in the snow, cut off his arm and said, your disciple's mind, he already declared himself a student. You know, your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. Your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, Master, put it to rest. So, you know, your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. And this is also very interesting because this comes back to, you know, our predicament. You could almost say it is a human predicament, a human condition, that we are not at rest. And then there is this drive to, you know, obviously get to that rest. Now, what's interesting here is, and I'm getting clearer on this myself, especially since starting doing the prison teaching, is that there are different levels of unrest and different levels, really different levels of looking at this. So the first one would be, say, trauma. If you've got trauma, you know, and we deal with people with really severe trauma in prison. We don't necessarily know what the trauma is, but they certainly sometimes they volunteer it. And you can imagine even being in prison, you know, they would have certainly inflicted in many ways trauma on other people. They themselves probably had a lot of trauma. So that is a level of unrest that is happening in the mind that we could call that really heavy karma. You know, if Jinko was a general, he would have carried heavy karma. He would have killed. He would have put people into battle. That would have been a really heavy karma to carry. You know, today we say soldiers, post-traumatic stress syndrome. That is really heavy karma to carry. You know, really heavy. How can you get a mind to rest when you have that sort of drama, that sort of karma? Now, coming back to, you know, how we teach this in prison, you know, what we teach in prison, it, and this is where merit comes in again, and this is where karma comes in again. You can't go to a prisoner or to someone that has got this heavy karma and say, there's no such thing as karma. There's no such thing as merit, you know. They are not at that level where they can see that. They don't want to see it. They don't want to sit facing the wall. They are too preoccupied with trauma. Hurting is happening so much. There is another level that needs to happen first. So like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, this really is the same thing. There is a hierarchy of needs when it comes to dealing with suffering. So in the Buddhist tradition, this is the Buddha recognized that already 2,500 years ago, you start off with teaching values. Simple things like values, like our precepts. And if we have a commitment to follow and make those precepts our anchor point in our life, we will start the process of settling. Even if we've done a lot of harm, you know, that will give us some stability in life. That is really important. So that is one of the, but it's a foundation. Margaret and I were at Woolston, at Borellen on, on Tuesday, yes. And this guy, we were talking just generally about the subject was suffering and pain. And, you know, generally, and he was really confused about how we can get rid of it. And eventually it came down to, well, he's talking about his son, his son was challenging him, but how can you tell me that if you don't do this yourself? And he's had this realization that he didn't know how to come back to his own son, because obviously, and in the end, it came down to, well, the reason is you don't have a value system, and you're not teaching your son a value system. The son has got no values. And he got that. He was really grateful. It was like a light bulb moment, didn't you think, for this guy? It was like, oh my God, that's what it is. It's actually, yes, you're right, I haven't got any. What are my values? What are values? What are they? What are some values you can adopt? He had no idea. And he didn't pass those values on. So if you haven't got values, anything goes. We can do anything. And of course, the karma just circulates. We do one thing after another, and it just never stops. We just keep going, doing the wrong thing, you know. But unless there is that value system that anchors us, it's really difficult, you know. So here, the appropriate teaching is really start off with values. And this is, of course, what early Buddhism teaches as well. You know, the monastics are the ones that deal with the no karma bit, that go into the realm that Zen goes into, the transpersonal realm. But the laity, you know, they get the foundations right until they are ready. Zen doesn't teach it like that, and that's why Zen is so radical. And Bodhidharma certainly has shown that when he cut straight to the chase, he went to the emperor and said, no merit, straight away cut in, you know, went to the heart of Buddhism, no merit at all, you know. But that can be problematic. So then the next level, if you like, for those people that have got mild trauma, we all have mild trauma, of course, anxiety. Oh, that's a big thing. Mental health issues is a big thing nowadays. So here again, you know, that's where conceptual Buddhism actually works, because conceptual Buddhism is like Buddhist psychology. You practice loving kindness, you practice goodness. We go through all this conceptual stuff. You know, these are the practices, and that'll make you feel better. So this is sort of more like, if you like, conceptual Buddhism goes into that. And then we come to the transpersonal part. And Zen very much, you know, teaches from this no-self, non-self perspective. Vast and void. From this vast and void no-self perspective. Melt into Mu. If I melt into Mu, there's no Ano, no Bodhidharma. It's just Mu. This transpersonal part. Not everyone is ready for that. Okay, so this hierarchy of suffering, if you like, is, I think, it's quite important to understand, and that puts into context, because I remember when I first looked at it, I thought it was so confusing, and it was almost contradictory. It's not contradictory when you see the process and when you see the levels and how it is taught and why it is taught that way. So Bodhidharma said, bring your mind to me and I will give it to rest. Bring your mind to me and I will give it to rest. What a great question. I want to study Zen. Yeah, I've got anxiety. Well, bring me your anxiety. Bring your mind to me. And now this is where really the journey starts, as in the search for self. Mind, what is mind? What is mind? I take possession of my mind. This is my mind. So another word for that is self. Have a look at that word, self. Who am I? What is my mind? So this is, bring that mind to me. Go and find it. bring that money. Where is it? And so the search starts. We're looking. I remember when, I started searching for my mind a long, long time ago for myself. I didn't know. I'd never formalized it that way. But the search was there. And at the time, it was God. You know. And so I was brought up, as you know, in a Catholic family. And my big question always was, what does God want? What does God want? You know? And tell me, what do you want? I'll do it. No problem. You know? And I could never find out what God wanted. Could never find out what God wanted. I went into monasteries, even as a youngster. I had to question people. You know, what does God want? What does God want? You know? Anyway, and then of course you go through all the rituals, whatever is in Catholicism and all of that. But this was a question, and the other question that drove my journey too was, if God is all that powerful, why is all this bad stuff happening? You know, why is all that bad stuff happening? Why can't he just flick a finger and it's done? There's no more Gaza, no more this, no more that. Why can't he just do that? You know. And I've told the story many times. You know, until someone said to me, don't you realize that God is nothing other than you? And at that moment, the bucket broke open to a degree, a large degree. There was no more God. That separation was gone. And all this time, what got me stuck was actually God, or will of God. That's what got me stuck. And once that stuckness was gone, it's nothing other than me, you know. That was like the beginning of where it started getting really interesting, the journey. And even then, when I had this experience, going to the various priests and the people that I knew that were really wise, they didn't know what to do with me. They could not answer that question. They could not say, what do you mean there's no God? What do you mean you are God, or God is you? You know, they didn't want to know that. And anyway, and this is again where conceptual Buddhism was very handy, because my experience was validated through the books I read about Zen. All of a sudden, I read some books and, oh my gosh, here it is. They didn't call it God, but here is exactly what I've experienced. And so that became a validation point, and that's how we should look at, in many ways, you know, this, you know, whatever we read. Does whatever we read, has that happened? You know, does that validate my own experience? If it doesn't, it doesn't mean it's not true. It just means I haven't experienced it yet. It's what wisdom is, empirical evidence through your senses, realizing it, and then validating it if you need to, you know, through maybe your teacher or whatever, or through books, if you can find a link there. So how long did actually Jinko now go and search for? We don't know that. It doesn't say that. But we all can relate it to us. We all have this urge to look for whatever it is we are looking for. My mind is not at rest. We don't even know what we are looking for. I'm really glad that Zen has developed this methodology of searching, and we have this wonderful systematic approach to this whole question in our tradition. We can thank Bodhidharma for that, and all the ancestors before and after. So the next thing is, I've searched for my... So the next thing is, the second, bring your mind to me and I will give it to rest. And then the ancestor obviously went through his search. And then he came back and he said, I have searched for the mind, but I've never been able to find it. And this is, I've never been able to find it. Vast and void. Not knowing. No merit. No cause and effect. I've never been able to find it. That was, what a find. I've never been able to find myself. This is I mean, Buddhism has a whole thing on non-self. This is this whole, I alone am the honored one. There is no one, there is no other. I've never been able to find my mind. There is nothing at all. Blank sheet of paper all the time. There's nothing at all. Blank sheet of paper all the time. And he realizes that everything is everything. Whatever appears on this blank sheet of paper is it, is nothing other than a blank sheet of paper, just another name. Whatever appears in our sitting is nothing other than me, myself. It just masquerades as form. It masquerades as something else, but it's not. That's what he realized. I've never been able to find it. This never is really powerful. I've never been able to find it. Not temporarily, but never been. He really got never. I've never been able to find it. And Bodhidharma said, I have finished putting it to rest for you. Who has finished? You know, this is a question. Who has finished putting the mind to rest? Who's Bodhidharma? Who's Bodhidharma? Who's sitting in front of the wall? What is Mu? He stopped trying to become someone. Imagine. You don't need to become someone anymore. You don't need to be anywhere anymore. It's all here. There is no someone. There's no somewhere. It's all war. That's what he discovered. So then we come to Mumon's commentary and verse. The broken toothed old barbarian came thousands of miles across the sea with an active spirit. The broken tooth, you know, apparently he, Bodhidharma, also had a hard time because he did not preach Orthodox Buddhism. So he challenged the hierarchy, you know, he challenged conventions. He's no merit. No, you know, vast and void, challenged a lot of people. So the story goes that he was poisoned, and people threw rocks at him, and that one of the rocks hit his mouth, and that caused his teeth to break. So the story goes, and so he's often called the broken-toothed old barbarian. He came thousands of miles across the sea with an active spirit. So this, you know, what do we get out of this? It's like, there is something, once we get it, there is some calling to start teaching it, to share it. And that's just what happens, you know. Of course, we've got to always be wary of false prophets, false teachers, you know. And every student has, or every practitioner, I should say, has the responsibility to discover for themselves whether they are in front of an authentic teacher or not, or authentic teachings or not. So that is the responsibility of every practitioner. And of course, there are people that, you know, and a good sign is money is usually a trap for a lot of teachers. If you can start making money out of the Dharma, or ego, you know, self-aggrandizement, you know, people all of a sudden put themselves first, titles and all of these things, you know, can trap teachers as well. So, but it is nevertheless important to find, and this is the responsibility of practitioners, to find teachers that you can connect with and that you think that are authentic. So this broken-toothed old barbarian came thousands of miles across the sea with an active spirit. It can rightly be said that he raised waves where there was no wind. Everything is everything. Everything is absolutely complete. There is no transmission. There is impossible to transmit, because what can you transmit? There's no you. How can you transmit anything? You know, there is nothing to transmit. So where's, you know, he raised waves where there is no wind. The no wind is this, you could, when you see this, when you really melt into Mu, when you really melt into the wall, there is no wind. It is always the way it is. There is nothing that is incomplete. There is nothing that is not right. There is nothing that needs to be saved. It is just always absolutely the way it should be, because that's the only way it can be. And here we are, trying to get it. Here we are, after all this time, you know, creating zendos and traveling and doing all of this, and everything is already the way it should be at all, at any given stage. So this is what this phrase is. In a way, it's funny. I don't know if you see the humor, but it is funny. It's like we're really crazy sitting here doing all of this. Like that. It's like, please see the funny side of this. You know, see the funny side. And that is what Mumu is saying. He says, in later life, he obtained one disciple, only one student yet. You know, Jinka, only one student. But even he was crippled. He cut off his arm. So you got this one-toothed barbarian and this other guy with only one arm, and even he was crippled, you know, in his sixth. And then he goes, ha! You know, he laughs. He goes, ha! You know, they didn't even know how to write. They didn't even know the ABC, he says. The fools do not even know the characters. But don't forget, they could point to the real thing. They couldn't read or write, but they pointed to the real thing. So this is Mumon's humor. The verse, coming from the west and pointing directly to it. So he really cuts to the chase, especially when he met the emperor. No merit, vast and void. I don't know. Don't know. Who are you? I don't know. Vast and void. He embodied his realization. Completely embodied his realization. It's the whole of Buddhism right there. That's the whole of Buddhism. These three things. It's coming from the west, pointing directly to it. High praise for Bodhidharma, even in appreciation, you know. All the trouble comes from the transmission. All the trouble comes from the transmission. Yeah. So there's many ways you can look at that. Like, what is transmission? And people get hung up on transmission. And have I got transmission? Haven't I got transmission? gets into politics. All the trouble, even wanting to teach the unteachable. You start getting into all these concepts. Then it gets back into metaphysics and dogma and all of these. All the trouble comes from the transmission. All the trouble started with Buddha having his awakening, and that's how Buddhism was created. The one who disturbs the monastery is originally you. The one who disturbs. Oh, it's cold. I need to put a jumper on. Oh, I'm hungry. I need to get something to eat. That bloody Trump and that Putin, I wish they'd be dead. I wonder what my family is doing while I'm sitting here. The one who disturbs is originally you. Please get that. Originally is originally. Can never be otherwise. It's always you. It's originally, no matter what it is, no matter what comes up on that white paper, no matter what comes up, no matter who you think about doing your zazen, it's originally you.